It's Philosophy Talk.
Amendment 2.
A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed.
2 centuries ago, our forefathers drafted an amendment with a vague meaning about arms and militia.
The only thing more bizarre about America than our gun laws is our lack of gun laws.
Would you like to buy your deadliest gun, please?
Aisle 6, next to the sympathy cones.
A gun is basically a tool for making small holes in distant animals, people, and property.
How can owning one be an inalienable right?
The words regulated and militia are in the first sentence. I don't think the framers were thinking of three guys in a Dodge Durango.
You don't really know what the framers were thinking, do you?
No.
If my gun protects my life and liberty and makes me quite happy, what's your problem?
Our guest is Hugh LaFollette from the University of South Florida in St. Petersburg.
Gun control. Coming up on Philosophy Talk.
As Thanksgiving approaches, we want you to know that we're grateful to you, our listeners.
Thank you for listening.
Thank you for thinking.
And thank you for supporting Philosophy Talk. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're here at the studios of KALW San Francisco.
Continuing conversations that begin at Philosopher's Corner at Stanford. That's where Ken teaches philosophy, and I did for 40 years.
Today, we're thinking about philosophy and gun control.
Ken, America is awash in guns. Some people think that's a good thing. Others passionately disagree. Guns and gun control are clearly hot-button political issues. But what's the philosophical question?
Well, here's one, John. Why should the citizens of a democratic society be armed to the teeth to begin with? How does gun ownership, widespread gun ownership, advance the common good?
What doesn't the Second Amendment answer that question? The wisdom of our founding fathers, quote, "A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed."
Ugh, only in America. Other liberal democracies don't see guns that way, and they're right. Look, the Second Amendment aside, there's just no good philosophical or moral justification for treating the right to keep and bear arms as a fundamental, uninfringable human right. Not in a free democratic society.
What, don't you believe in the right of self-defense?
Well, of course I do.
What, doesn't a right to bear arms follow directly from the right of self-defense?
Well, haven't you read your John Locke, John? When you consent to enter the social contract and allow yourself to be governed by the state, he says, you wholly transfer your inherent right of self-defense to the state. And that's why we have, you know, courts and cops and armies and all that jazz, John.
Yeah, I've read Locke, and so did the Founding Fathers. A lot of good that would do me if somebody breaks into my house. Wait for the government? No thanks. They put a right to keep and bear arms in the Constitution for a good reason.
Oh, come on. They did it just because they had to make certain compromises with those darn slave-owning Southerners.
Okay, Ken, I'm willing to grant you that the right to own a gun isn't necessarily a fundamental right. But it's at least a derivative right.
I'm not sure what you're getting at. Tell me more.
Well, take the right to free speech. It's not worth much if you're allowed to speak, but not to publish, broadcast, or nowadays tweet, whatever that is, and email. Maybe you don't have a fundamental right to tweet or email, but you have a derived right,
oh,
don't you?
I don't see how that helps justify a right to bear guns. You want the power to shoot people who try to silence you or something? Is that what you're getting at?
No, Ken, you're missing the point. Big surprise. Yes, we have a fundamental right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. But these don't amount to much unless you can defend yourself against those who are going to deprive you of those things, including the government, I might add. Ergo, you have a derivative right to guns as a means of securing your more fundamental rights.
I don't agree. Look, when it comes to securing fundamental rights, guns are the problem. John, they're not the solution. Living in a society in which every miscreant or malcontent has the power to kill diminishes my right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. It doesn't secure it.
Well, just because people have the power to kill doesn't mean they have the right to kill. Driving an automobile gives you the power to kill. You can run over people. but it doesn't give you the right to do so.
Oh, but look, there's a huge difference between guns and cars. Cars aren't designed to kill people. Guns are. That's all they're for, killing people.
Nevertheless, we trust most people not to use their cars to kill. And why can't we trust most gun owners not to use their guns to kill, except in the case of extreme self-defense?
Oh, come on, Don. Trust only goes so far. And take cars. We license car drivers. We insist that they be trained and insured. We don't allow nutcases to drive. We tax cars. We keep careful track of who owns what car. Now, are you willing to have analogous safeguards for guns too, John?
If you will admit that some people really should have the right to a gun, then I'll accept those safeguards. Think of an old person living alone in the woods, or a family in a neighborhood full of criminals. Police protection is often too little and too late.
But look, John, other societies get by without anybody, not even the police, having guns. So why can't we?
Well, because of the Second Amendment. Oh. It's part of our national culture.
God, that again. Look, exactly how the Founding Fathers, in their infinite non-wisdom, I say, ended up with that nightmare of an amendment? That's not a pretty story, dude.
Well, so I understand. We sent our roving philosophical reporter, Shuka Kalantari, to speak with a gun law expert about the evolution of this right to keep and bear arms. She files this report.
We've all seen movies about the Wild Wild West. Charlton Heston, John Wayne, Randolph Scott, shootouts at dawn, shootouts in smoky saloons over the ladies, shootouts all night long.
In truth, the Wild West was much less violent than people remember.
Adam Rinkler is a law professor at the University of California, Los Angeles. He says the old American frontier actually had a lot of gun laws.
Places like Dodge City, Kansas, or Tombstone, Arizona, or Deadwood, South Dakota, you had to check your guns. So visitors would turn them over to the local marshal, who'd often give them a little token that they could come back and reclaim their gun.
Kind of like checking your coat at the opera. In the U.S., as long as there's been a constitution, there's been a right to bear arms.
But we've also always had gun control. The Founding Fathers who wrote the Second Amendment did not believe that there was a libertarian license for anyone to have any gun anywhere they wanted. And in fact, they supported a wide range of different kinds of gun regulations. Both slaves and free blacks were barred from having guns, as were white loyalists.
Racist and political regulations, but regulations nonetheless. Rinkler says the Founding Fathers wrote the Second Amendment so citizens could go home, grab their guns, and be ready to fight for their country in an instant. But by the mid-1800s, some of these citizen soldiers became repurposed as slave patrols.
They would use these local militias to capture slaves that had run away and to return them back and to otherwise instill fear in slaves so that they wouldn't escape.
Soon after the Civil War, the Ku Klux Klan was formed with the goal of reestablishing white supremacy.
In the South, African Americans had never been allowed to own guns before the Civil War. But in the Civil War, many African Americans got their hands on guns in the South. Some served in Union Army units, and they were allowed to keep their guns after the war, and thought that they would have guns to defend themselves against white racists. Those white racists were determined to take those guns away, feeling that if blacks were denied the ability to fight back, white supremacy would be that much easier to reestablish.
Fast forward to 1967. African Americans are still being targeted by the KKK and the police. So the Black Panthers show up at the California State House exercising their right to bear arms.
30 of them with firearms in tow, loaded rifles, pistols, and shotguns. And they walked right into the legislative chamber, the California Assembly, while it was in session debating a law.
The Black Panthers were protesting a law being considered that day.
And it was a gun control law. It was a law that was being pushed by California Republicans to try to make it harder for the Black Panthers to carry their guns in public and to intimidate police officers and others.
The Black Panther Party for Self-Defense calls upon the American people in general and the black people in particular to take careful note of the racist California legislature, which is now considering legislation aimed at keeping the black people disarmed and powerless.
Republicans and conservatives at the time come out strongly against the Black Panthers' gun ownership and strongly in favor of gun control. The story touches upon the close and troublesome relationship between gun regulation in American history and race and racism.
There are some 320 million guns in America today. UCLA law professor Adam Rinkler says whether we like it or not, those guns are here to stay.
What we should be doing is focusing on what kinds of gun regulations we can have that are effective to try to reduce crime, limit access to guns by the mentally ill, and otherwise make our communities safer for all Americans.
Passing new regulations may not be easy, but Rinkler says if the Wild West can have effective gun laws, so can 21st century America. For Philosophy Talk, I'm Shuka Kalantari.
I'm John Perry. Thank you, Shuka, for that informative report. Here with me is my fellow Stanford philosopher, Ken Taylor.
And today we're thinking about philosophy and gun control. We're joined now by Hugh LaFollette. He's a professor of philosophy at the University of South Florida, St. Petersburg, and he's author of The Practice of Ethics. Hugh, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Hello, how are you?
So Hugh, as a philosopher, what drew you to the topic of gun control?
Well, I assume you're largely asking an autobiographical question, although at the end it has philosophical overtones. I grew up in the South. My father was an avid hunter and gun owner. I grew up wanting to be with my father, and the greatest gift I ever got on my birthday was my first shotgun, because it meant in my mind that my father saw me as an adult male. So I understand the appeal of the gun culture, especially as it involves hunting. On the other hand, I had not thought about the issue very much philosophically until 1996, when I was spending the year at the University of Stirling in Scotland. For those of you who do not know, Stirling is close to a town, little town called Dunblane. Just before I went, William Hamilton walked into an elementary school at Dunblane and killed 17 young children, including the son of a former member of the philosophy department that I was working in. I found myself suddenly confronting the issue. I got to know and interviewed the attorney who represented the parents of the children who were killed in that elementary school. So I have an autobiographical interest, which became a philosophical interest.
Cool.
So, Hugh, there's a lot of armchair arguments about gun control, some of which Ken and I rehearsed. There's some statistics that go around, mostly paraded by anti-gun people and made fun of by gun people. But do we really know anything? Can you clarify what, if anything, we really know about guns and the comparative situations with guns in various countries or anything else?
I can try. Let me just say, I don't want to put down armchair arguments, and we can talk about this later if you wish. I happen to think they're extremely important, including for understanding and evaluating the empirical evidence. Part of the problem is we do not have a lot of empirical evidence. And one of the reasons we don't is that some years ago, the Republican Congress passed a bill which forbade the Centers for Disease Control from collecting or helping anyone collect information that could be used to support gun control. So we actually have a law which makes it difficult, if not impossible, to get good evidence.
Well, but Hugh, we do have vast social differences between European democracies on the one hand and America on the other. Can't we do a kind of comparative analysis? Because we've taken two radically different paths and have radically different outcomes. Can't we do a kind of comparative analysis international?
To some degree. Some years ago, the National Academies of Science set up a study group to look at the question of what we did and didn't know and what we should do. What they concluded is we don't know very much. Now, as it turns out, having said that, the one thing they admitted that we do know is that there is, as you suggested, a correlation, likely a correlation, between private gun ownership and homicide rates. It's particularly obvious when you compare countries to countries. It's also obvious when you look within the United States. For example, New England, which is very urbanized, actually has by far the lowest homicide rate of any area of the country. And when you look comparatively, the only country that appears to come close to us was Northern Ireland in the period called the Troubles. Once you leave that, the next country is Finland, which has a homicide rate one-third that of ours.
Wow.
So why doesn't that suggest that, you know, the prevalence of guns and the rate of homicide and suicides and gun accidents are at least highly correlated? If, you know, I mean, people might find a way to kill each other without guns, but with guns, it's so much easier to kill, and it's and with readily available guns. I mean, why not just make that, that conclusion?
Well, you could. And actually, the National Academies of Science did. On the other hand, pro-gun advocates have had several champions recently. One, a fellow by the name of Gary Kleck, who's argued that there are enormous numbers of defensive gun uses, which goes back to the issue of self-defense, which you raised earlier. And a fellow by the name of John Lott has tried to talk about the merits of open carry laws.
So, look,
so they say, in fact, yeah, it, these figures are misleading, and they're misleading because they ignore the benefits of private gun ownership.
I get that kind of argument. We'll have to dig in and see how good or bad those arguments are as we continue. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today, we're thinking about philosophy and gun control.
In our next segment, we're going to talk more about the nature of the right to possess guns, a basic right, a derived right, something more complicated, a fluke with no foundation in the nature of justice and human rights. What's the case?
Arms, arguments, and amendments. Plus, your calls and emails when Philosophy Talk continues.
After Black Friday and Cyber Monday, don't forget about Giving Tuesday.
That's your opportunity to give back to the community and to support organizations that make the world a better place.
Do we make the world a better place?
We definitely make the world a better place. We open eyes to different points of view. We bring philosophical thought to a broad public. We show people how to disagree without sending angry tweets.
So remember Philosophy Talk on Tuesday, November 27th.
And throughout the giving season.
All donations are tax deductible and directly support our production costs.
Help keep us on the air and online.
Thank you for listening.
Thank you for thinking.
And thank you for your support.
In a country with a constitutional right to bear arms, sometimes you have to run faster than a bullet. I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor, and we're thinking about gun control.
Our guest is Hugh LaFollette from the University of South Florida in St. Petersburg.
So, Hugh, I want to go back to a distinction John made at the beginning. He seemed to agree that gun ownership is not a fundamental right. He said it's a derived right. Some people might think, I think I tend to think, that it's not a right at all. Where do you come down on that question? I know it can be complicated arguments, but let's start. Where do you come down on the question? No right, fundamental right, derived right?
I would want to say if you're going to talk about there being a right at all, it would have to be a derived right. I don't think there's a particularly good case for making it a fundamental right. And even if you look at the Supreme Court decision in District of Columbia versus Heller, which is often cited by pro-gun advocates, what you see is, though they said it does involve some sort of right to bear arms, it is not an unconditional right. And they talk about a variety of laws that we already have in the books that prohibit the kinds of guns we have, who can own them, and how they can own them.
Yeah, but I want to bracket the Second Amendment just for a second, right? Because,
sure.
I mean, we have the Second Amendment, and it does confer a political right. But I want to imagine starting from scratch and having a liberal society. Where does the right to bear arms enter into the picture? As a fundamental inalienable thing, since maybe in the state of nature we have that right? I mean, or is it like Locke says, well, we give up certain rights to enter into... I mean... independently of our particular constitution.
Sure.
Where does the right to bear arms come in the panoply of rights? And why?
Well, again, I think the most plausible case can be to make it a derivative right. And it can come from two different forms. One is a general claim that people have a right to freedom. They have a right to do what they want to do as long as it doesn't hurt someone else. And if they see owning a gun as falling under that description, then they think they have a derivative right. The second and more common argument for a derivative right comes from the right of self-defense, the claim that I'm the best person to defend myself. I need to be able to have a gun to defend myself against an aggressor.
But the kind of paradoxical thing is that that seems true in at least large parts of the U.S. There's so many guns around that the chances of a 7-Eleven clerk or a lonely widow out in the woods having to confront someone with a gun are not as low as one might hope. But if we didn't have all those guns, then we wouldn't need them to defend ourselves. So isn't it? It's kind of a paradoxical derived right.
Sure, it may well be that the reason we have the problem that we have, the people reason need guns, is because so many people already have guns. It's an issue, and again, I don't see any simple way to resolve this issue. Sometimes owning a gun will be beneficial in defending yourself. Sometimes owning a gun will be beneficial in defending someone else. Sometimes it might be helpful in protecting yourself against an aggressive totalitarian regime. The issue is how often that happens.
But let me ask you another question.
Do the cost trump the benefits?
Theo, let me ask you another question, though. I mean, almost nobody I know, although I did read one thing that said, yeah, we could justify hand grenades and bazookas and tanks because the totalitarian government could come at it, you know. But almost nobody I know advocates for the widespread ownership of machine guns or rocket-propelled grenades. So what is the principle that says, okay, these guns are okay for self-defense, these weapons, these arms, but these aren't? And because if it's self-defense or all this sort of stuff, look, if you bring a knife, I'm going to bring a gun. If you bring a gun, I'm going to bring a machine gun. If you bring a machine gun, I'm going to bring a bazooka, right? Because I don't want to treat you as an equal. I want to kick your butt. So what's going to stop this argument for self-defense? What's the limiting principle?
I'm not sure there is one. I mean, I think you're right to point out that there's a problem here, that if you're going to say people have a right to whatever they need to defend themselves, and you acknowledge that at least in some cases, however rare, you might need a half track to defend yourself or a howitzer to defend yourself, then you would seem to have a right to have a howitzer or a half track. But as you point out, even most gun advocates don't hold that position. So it's got to be, that's why I think the issue of cost and benefits is so important, is what kind of guns are most likely to provide protection against aggression. And the claim there is that in most cases it's a handgun, but of course handguns are also the most likely to be used aggressively.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking about philosophy and gun control. We'd love to have you join this conversation. And Dave from San Francisco is on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Dave. What's your comment or question?
Well, I was taught as an elementary student that the reason the Second Amendment is there is because in those days, the king owned the army and opposed the settlers, and the settlers wanted to ensure that future settlers would have the right to have arms and oppose an oppressive king from afar. And that seemed like good reasoning in those days, but it sure seems alien to today's society. I'm wondering, is the original argument for the Second Amendment still significant, still valid, or do we need to rely on some other argument for why there is a right to guns?
Well, that's a really good question, Dave. And Hugh, I'm going to just turn that over to you. Is he right about the original justification for the Second Amendment? And second, does that argument, if it were the argument, still apply today?
I think there are interesting historical questions about the exact origins of the Second Amendment. I would simply say this. As a matter of law, the court's ruling in District of Columbia versus Heller settles the constitutional question, at least for now. But as we pointed out earlier, that also is compatible with all sorts of gun control. So I actually think the court made a mistake, and I would simply base it on the introductory clause. I think it modifies the situation under which we have a right to bear arms in a way that the courts did not acknowledge.
But
that's a legal question.
So the Second Amendment was really, at the time, it was a restriction on the federal government. And the federal government at that time wasn't so clear what it was going to turn out to be. I mean, George Washington hadn't yet set the precedent that the president would not be king-like and so forth and so on. A lot of gun owners I know now really, though, think that somehow defying the federal government is part of why they should own guns. But, geez, I wouldn't want to defy the federal government. with a handgun or even a rifle, you know. So it really plus, as you mentioned, this odd thing, a well-regulated militia. I mean, it seems to me in that opinion, Scalia just kind of ignores that. So the whole thing is a bit of a mystery. I don't know if there's a question there. There's just a reaction.
Well, I'm going to ask you a historical question. I don't know whether this is true or not, but I have read, and I actually believe, but I don't know if I am right to believe it, that well-regulated militia clause in the Second Amendment had a concrete historical reference. It was a concrete historical reference to the slave militias of the South. And the Southerners feared that the federal government, which was dominated by the large northern states, would not come to the rescue of the state if there were a slave uprising. And they lived in deadly fear of the slave uprising. So the well-regulated militia is the slave militia to keep the slaves in their place. I mean, and that's why we have the Second Amendment. Nothing about fundamental rights. It's about the politics of North and South in the antebellum USA. Well, is that a fair historical reading or not?
I'm not sure I know enough of the history to say for sure it is. It might be, but it may also be that there are other reasons why guns are seen as so important and why we have the Second Amendment. I do think it's partly a historical accident. The United States came to be at a time in which firearms, which had been around for about 800 years, suddenly became cheaper, more deadly, more effective, and quicker. And so I think the reason guns play such a dynamic role in the U.S. is a historical accident. Also, part of that accident is, at the end of the Civil War, it wasn't just Union soldiers that were allowed to keep guns. It was also Confederate soldiers.
Yeah. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking about the philosophy and gun control. We'd love to have you join this conversation. And Pat in San Francisco is on the line. Welcome to the Philosophy Talk, Pat.
Yes. As much as I would like to not have a world of no guns, the reality is we have individuals in our society who are violent and use violence for their own means. While we may not have a king to worry about, we do have individuals that can cause a lot of physical harm. And the reality is we do not have sufficient law enforcement to protect the public. And things can happen so quickly that you do not have time to call the police, and you have to protect yourself.
So the conclusion is, I'm not quite sure what the conclusion is. What is the conclusion?
The conclusion is to unfortunate, necessary evil.
Thanks for the call, Pat, and the question. I want to know what you think, Hugh. Is it gun ownership, widespread gun ownership, an unfortunate, necessary evil in America today?
Well, it's probably at least unfortunate, and it may or may not be necessary. The one thing I would say that the caller's question brings up, I think is very important when we're talking about this issue. There seems to be an assumption that the only people who cause harm with guns are somehow violent individuals. That's just a mistake. It's a mistake when it comes to homicides. It's a mistake when it comes to accidents. It's mistakes when it comes to suicides. Pretty decent people who've never violated the law, they get drunk, they get jealous, they get mad, a gun's to hand, they're more likely to use it. Well, let me just give you one example. There's a petition going around right now that would request the Republican National Committee to allow carrying guns in the Republican National Convention.
Oh, God. Hoisted on their own petard.
It seems to me that if you really thought that everyone having guns would be a good thing, you ought to be saying, absolutely, we want that. The same point would go with Congress. You cannot carry a gun into Congress. The Republicans control Congress. If they think if carrying guns is a great thing, why not have open carry in the House?
But
in
look,
the Senate?
You got to admit something. I think our roving philosophical report brought this out nicely. Most of the arguments about gun ownership, at least those offered by the political class and the gun lobby and the gun manufacturer, I'm not talking about the ordinary citizen. They're completely dishonest, right? Because if applied consistently, they wouldn't be objecting to the Black Panthers. I mean, if an armed black man is frightening in a way to some people that an armed white man is not. And when it's whites in the South or in the rural demanding access to gun, people say, oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. When it, if it were blacks in the inner city. So there are no arguments. And this is one of the things
or
I
Muslims.
Hate about. Yes, there are no arguments that anybody is willing to consistently and honestly apply in this mess of a debate, I think. At least none of the advocates for guns. I mean, I hate to sound like a curmudgeon, but that's what it seems to me. American politics is so corrupt that sincere, reasoned arguments consistently applied, they're just mostly absent in this debate.
I think there probably are some people who would advocate that consistent position, but I also think you're right. Many of them wouldn't.
I mean, even Bernie Sanders, who is a politically pure person, as you will get in American politics, isn't consistent and sincere on the arguments of guns. Political expediency plays a role in his thinking about this, too.
Well, I'm not so sure. I mean, the gun control legislation he opposed, he claims to have opposed on principle because it would make gun companies liable in ways that other companies aren't. I'm not saying I'm convinced. But
I think if gun companies were strictly liable, that would be a darn good thing. We've got a caller. I don't see the caller's name. Welcome to Philosophy
Harold.
Talk, caller. Who?
Harold.
Harold in Half Moon Bay. They put you up late. Welcome to Philosophy Talk. What's your comment or question, Harold?
It's an asymmetry argument, which has to do with the number of guns that are already in place. It's asymmetrical to go figure out a way to go backwards versus had we had more restrictive gun ownership from the jump. And to me, that it's so asymmetrical and has so many perverse effects to try to confiscate and reduce guns that it has to be part of the logic. It's a fact that's so big it has to be part of the logic.
I think you're making thanks for the call, Harold. I think you're making an excellent point that applies to lots of stuff. The path dependency of the politically possible, I like to call it, that if you're blind to path dependency and you just talk pure moral principles, you're going to make a mess of politics. But what do you think about Harold's point, Hugh?
No, I agree. That any accounting of what we ought to do has got to look at the fact that there are lots of Americans, although fewer than you might think, who are completely wedded to having and owning their guns. So simply taking them away, even if it were a good idea in principle, may not be doable. The analogy here would be prohibition. I like my beer as much as anyone else. On the other hand, I happen to think the world probably would have been better off without alcohol. That as much as I like it, the damage that it's done has been enormous. I'm probably inclined to say the same thing about guns, but the fact is we do have a history of having guns. We have it in a way that no other country has. And so getting rid of them or even seriously controlling them is going to be a problem to a degree here that it won't be anywhere else.
Yeah, I think you're right. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're thinking about philosophy and gun control with Hugh LaFollette, author of The Practice of Ethics.
In our next segment, suppose we set aside the issue of what's politically possible and concentrate on what makes sense. What would a rational gun policy for America be?
Revolvers, rationality, and rewriting the Second Amendment and the law when Philosophy Talk continues.
If you enjoy our program, there are lots of ways you can support what we do.
Subscribe to our enormous archive of past episodes.
Buy subscriptions for the thinkers in your life.
Purchase someone a mug, tote, or tea at our new online shop.
Or make a tax-deductible donation by going to philosophytalk.org.
Please do your part to help keep us on the air and online.
Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.
And now, back to the show. Is it warm?
John Lennon, ironically, tongue-in-cheek, happiness is a warm gun, life, liberty, and the pursuit of a warm gun. I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor. Our guest is Hugh LaFollette from the University of South Florida, St. Petersburg. And we're thinking about philosophy, gun control, and the right to keep and bear arms. And we've got a caller on the line, Anthony from San Francisco. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Anthony.
Good morning. I'm curious about the role of the gun manufacturers in this whole debate as a moral issue. We seem to talk about guns as if they grow on trees, or maybe we make our own in our garages. But there are big companies that make a lot of money producing these things, and all of the financial support, opposing any kind of gun regulation comes from the manufacturers. And I'd just like to hear the guests talk about that.
Yeah, Hugh, I'd love to hear you talk about that. I have a proposal that gun manufacturers should be subject to strict liability, even if they're not negligent. Some people think, yeah, if they're negligent and selling guns to somebody that they knew to be crazy or blah, 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 they should be held responsible. I'm willing to go with the strict liability. And even if they're not negligent, they should be held accountable. What do you think about those kind of ideas?
Well, okay, let me start with the question of the manufacturer, and then if you want to ask me about the others, will. I mean, it is true that gun manufacturers do play an important role in this issue, both in terms of producing the goods. As with most producers, they produce goods which people want, and they also create in people the belief that they need to have the product, whatever it happens to be, whether it be a gun or whether it be a Coca-Cola. And particularly in the case of the National Rifle Association, my understanding anyway is that the gun manufacturers are the primary people who support it and the primary people to whom the NRA answer. I think you're right. That raises interesting and important questions.
Yeah, but I want to know what you think about the liability issue. To what extent should they be held liable for the damage done with the product that they create?
Well, okay, I want to shift. I think there's a special and interesting argument to make about gun manufacturers, but let's set it aside for a moment and simply ask about the gun owners. It seems to me that there's a two-pronged proposal that you could make. One is that gun owners would have to have insurance in the same way that a car owner has to have insurance. And the idea is that if damage is done by your car, even if you're not negligent, your insurance will pay for whatever damage is done. It seems to me the same thing could arguably be true, should be true for guns. Now, there's a second question, although I think it's independent from the first. I think you could have an insurance, a requirement that you have insurance. The second issue is, should you have strict liability for gun owners such that if damage or harm is done with that gun, even if it's through no negligence at all of that individual, for example, the gun is stolen, should they be liable? I think there's a case to be made, and it would be backed up by some kind of liability insurance.
So Hugh, kind of extending this, and suppose we made you czar for a day, or maybe it would take longer than a day, and you didn't have to worry about the Republicans or the Democrats or anybody. You could just rewrite America's laws, and you could do it in a way that, you know, did one thing for a year and then did another thing for a year, given the fact that we've got all these guns already. And you could even rewrite the Second Amendment so it would be clearer and less ambiguous and better.
What? Or repeal it.
Or repeal it. So what would you do?
Well, actually, if I may take a riff off of another thinker, I'm not sure I want to be a czar of any country that would make me czar. But that said, what would I do? Well, I can't ask the question completely in the abstract, because it's not entirely in the abstract. We live in a country where we have guns. Part of the answer would be the two answers I just gave in terms of insurance and strict liability. But the other two proposals I would make is, I think the idea of gun-free zones is meritorious. I think most people realize it's meritorious. I think the Republicans realize it's meritorious. I think continuing to have them is a good thing, and we could talk about exactly where that would be. Certainly universities would be one of them. I'm not sure I want to teach in a university where my students are packing. But the second is, even the advocates, the strongest philosophers anyway, who argue for a right to bear arms, are really just arguing against banning guns. They realize that there's some firearms that should not be available. They realize there's some people, mentally incompetent individuals, former felons, who shouldn't have guns. And they realize there's some ways that perhaps those guns ought to be stored. There's no way that you can enforce those principles unless you have some kind of registration. And registration would also give us the advantage of having additional information if we were trying to make decisions about the relative costs and benefits of guns.
Well, you seem like a wise czar to me. We've got a caller. Chris in San Francisco is on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Chris.
Thank you. Getting into what the gentleman was saying about the regulation and so forth, what some sort of middle ground, what would stop, like, I mean, the federal or a state government or local government or private entity or whatever from organizing a militia? And since the Constitution says something about well-regulated militia, to more or less govern the people that feel like they need a gun, to be not to have a violent history, to be medically, psychologically.
Wait a minute, Chris. Slow down here. I mean, you and I don't have the right, I don't think.
So I think his idea is that if you follow the Second Amendment, let's say, well, the states can have militias, and if you're part of the militia, you can own a gun. But you got to pass some tests to get into the militia. Is that the idea?
Is that the idea, Chris?
Well, sure, yeah. That, to be a somewhat physically able marksman, so you're not, to be, tested and therefore regulated.
I get you, Chris. Let's turn this over to Hugh. Thanks for the question, Chris. What do you think, Hugh?
I'm not sure if there would be a rationale for having or establishing a formal militia, but you could do everything the listener suggested simply by passing laws, not all that different than the laws we have in many states right now. We have laws in many states that require registration of some weapons. We have laws in many states against owning certain weapons. We have laws in all states against owning some weapons. Nobody can have nuclear weapons or chemical weapons.
That's a relief.
Yeah. But look, I don't understand something. Maybe I'm a naive reader of the Second Amendment, and I understand that in that Heller decision, they talked a lot about the purpose of that clause, a well-regulated militia. It was just sort of preparatory. But it sounds to me like it really is saying, well, states can have militias. States can call the citizens to the militias. So states can say, okay, you can have guns, but states can also regulate who. I mean, that's what it looks like on the face, but it seems not to be taken that way. Am I just being naive in my reading of the Second Amendment?
No, I mean, that may be partly right. I mean, my own understanding of the amendment is, again, looking at the original clause, a well-regulated militia being necessary for the security of a free state. And I think about what happened if we had a clause, something like that clause, in front of the right of free speech. In order to have a free and open and vibrant democracy, the right of free speech and association and press shall not be infringed. All of a sudden, the right to free speech and the right to freedom of the press has changed.
Well, right. So are you and I agreeing or not? I'm not quite sure. I mean, it seems to me something about the well-regulated militia and its indispensability to a free state, the security of a free state, justifies the ownership of guns, but only to the extent that it serves that broader purpose, and it's up to the state to decide what regimen of gun ownership serves that broader purpose. That's what it sounded like to me. It doesn't sound like it gives the individual the absolute infringible right to own a gun.
Yeah, well,
even the Supreme Court said that, yes.
Yeah, that's
There's an ambiguity in the term state here, too. Do we mean an individual state like Alabama or Tennessee or California, or do we mean the nation state?
Well, the way I take the Second Amendment, not that I have a right to have a legal opinion, but given the time, it sounds like it was aimed at the federal government. That's all the Bill of Rights really at that time pertained to, and it's protecting the states from the possibility that the federal government will remove their ability to resist the federal government. This was at the time when they were forming the federal government. Now, what happened after the Civil War, where all the things were kind of extended to the states?
Well,
I don't
yeah.
know. With this amendment, it seems kind of incoherent.
Yeah, the 14th Amendment would seem like it would seem like a strange thing because it seems like it's limiting the state with respect to a power that the state is granted by the original Constitution. What do you think, Hugh? One last thought. Give us one on whatever you want. We have time for one last thought.
Yeah. One last thought. My goodness.
It goes by fast.
Well, okay. In a way, this is often a tangent, but I think it's worth pointing out. There's an interesting dilemma for individuals who want to own guns. And the dilemma is this. They say the reason they want to own guns defensively is so they can stop the commission of a crime. Now, in order to be able to stop a commission of a crime, the gun has to be close to hand. It has to be loaded. It has to be able to be picked up and used in very quickly without much warning. The problem is, the more to hand it is, the more likely it's loaded. Also, the more danger it can present for a young child picking it up, for someone using it in anger. So a loaded gun that is going to be effective, an effective defensive weapon, is also more likely to be something that damages public safety. And if you try to protect public safety, then you've got to restrict the benefits or the use and the availability of guns self-defensively.
Good point, Hugh. And on that note, I'm going to thank you for joining us. This has been a really interesting conversation.
Thanks a lot. It's been fun.
Our guest has been Hugh LaFollette. He's a professor of philosophy at the University of South Florida, St. Petersburg, and he's author of The Practice of Ethics. So, John, we don't really have time. You have one really quick thought?
No, I don't have any quick thoughts on this.
So, okay.
I don't like guns in my house. That's all.
Okay. So this conversation continues at Philosopher's Corner at our online community of thinkers, where our motto is cogito ergo blogo. I think, therefore I blog. And you too can become a partner in that community just by the simple act of visiting our website, philosophytalk.org.
Now, which amendment gives us the right to bear speed? Let's ask Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher.
Ian Scholes, I don't know what's going on with America anymore, frankly. We all seem to be hell-bent on pursuing the worst ideas anybody's ever had about anything ever. Notions about guns seem to lead the stupidity pack. One recent notion was that we could help reduce rapes on campus by arming co-eds. Presumably, they'd pull a handgun from their corset or whatever if touched inappropriately and blow the perp away. This is not a good idea. Or maybe it is. I don't even know anymore. I suppose the number of rapes on campus would be drastically reduced, but I also suppose the number of tender sexual encounters would also diminish. I can't see teenage boys entering into an intimate situation that could result in a sucking chest wound. Well, wait, I guess I can. Of course, the boys arm themselves as well. And sex on campus will become like the end of the epic Western Duel in the Sun, with Gregory Peck and Jennifer Jones, where they shoot each other repeatedly as they crawl towards each other across the desert to die in each other's arms. Man, there was an ending. But there's no end to gun craziness. Apparently, soon there'll be no restrictions of gun ownership. Everyone will have a gun, even toddlers and kickboxers. That's where we're heading. Iowa just passed a law allowing children to have handguns with adult supervision. To teach them gun safety is the idea. It's educational, like Sesame Street, only more street. And maybe we should all just embrace it. If somebody cuts me off in traffic, I won't honk the horn anymore. I'll just fill my hand with iron and blow the driver away. I should roll the window down first, I guess, and I'll have to shoot left-handed, depending on which side I got cut off. And I guess I should buy a holster for the gun, at least make sure the gun doesn't snag on my belt when I'm drawing. But okay, get over those obstacles. I shout, use your directionals. What's wrong with you? Just before I open fire, pow, pow, pow. Or maybe just one pow. I've been practicing at the range. I can put him down with a single shot to the head. Okay, job done. Rage soothed by gunfire. But now, there's traffic issues, don't you think? You're doing 65, 70 miles an hour. Suddenly you got a deceased driver. You're going to have a car or two spinning out of control and heavy traffic or tumbling end over end in flames. That would be cool, of course, if you want to live or die in a Mad Max movie. But it is majorly inconvenient, and you probably have to pay for it. The cleanup, the lawsuit by surviving kin, unless insurance in the future covers this sort of thing. And even if it does, Congress will spend all its time blocking it because it's socialism. It's already kind of problematic, isn't it? So I tell you what, forget the whole thing. Using Westerns as our model, again, which it seems we must because we just can't have nice things, we should check our guns at the edge of town. Just like in Rio Bravo, Dean Martin had the job of taking the six shooters, I think. Or maybe I'm thinking of Robert Mitchum in El Dorado. Anyway, like the song says, don't take your guns to town. Big hit for Johnny Cash in 1958. Who, even at the height of his fame, did not carry. I gotta go.
Don't take your guns to town, son. Leave your guns at home, Bill. Don't take your guns to town.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Manila Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2016.
Our executive producer is David Demarest.
The program is produced by Devin Strolovich. Laura McGuire is our director of research. Dave Millar is our director of marketing.
Thanks also to Merle Kessler, Mark Stone, Erica Topete, and Ted Muldoon.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from various groups at Stanford University and the partners at our online community of thinkers.
And from the members of KALW San Francisco, local public radio, where our program originates.
The views expressed or misexpressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
Not even when they're true and reasonable. The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org, where you, too, can become a partner in our community of thinkers.
I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.
A gun is not a weapon, Marge. It's a tool, like a butcher knife or a harpoon or an alligator.